so many people from my childhood, adolescence especially, characterized me as, you know, super confident, as like an alpha female. And I was like, what are you talking about? Are you insane? Like, I was a teeming mess of anxiety and fear inside. And so that vigilance can create like that almost like sentinel, you know, kind of a soldier quality where we're just have this shell of protection. And so that protection can sometimes look like, you know, arrogance or confidence, but it's actually masking something that is really defended. You know, it's a really defended heart.
I am Matteo Bornico, and welcome to Create Belonging, the podcast where we explore the world through the lens of belonging. It is my pleasure to be back for part two of my conversation with the writer and meditation teacher, Sabine Selassie. In the previous episode, Sabine and I, we get into a conversation about the importance of grounding yourself and the power of self-exploration to find our way back to our belonging. And on part two, we make a switch from talking about belonging to ourselves to what it means to belong with others. This brings us to touch on some topics like power dynamics in society, context switching, fluency versus vigilance. We talk about the fatigue that minorities tend to experience when they are constantly vigilant and monitoring on whether they belong or whether they're fitting in, and why affinity groups might offer some respite from this fatigue. And towards the end, I asked Sabine the question about what her vision for the future is. And instead of painting the picture of what that future will look like, she answers the question by talking about how she would like to feel in that future. And she gives us some clues on the type of world that we should all be striving towards. We cover a wide range of topics. And so, as it was the case in part one, I am incredibly happy and honored to welcome you back to part two of my conversation with the wonderful, wise, and present Sabine Selassie.
I recently took part in one of your workshops. One of the things that right before we started the workshop is that you split everybody into two categories. You asked everybody to first state if they're white or they're a person of color, also to put their pronouns. And I caught myself reacting to that when I first got that email to please do that. I'm like, why? Like, why do you want to categorize people? I don't want to categorize people. That's the whole purpose of what I'm trying to do. It really triggered me in a way. But then I remember who you are. I remembered your book. And I remember that, okay, I need to go along with it and I need to better understand. So now it's my question to you. Why did you do that? Why did you split the group into people of color and people of white? And have you done that often? Is that very common in North America maybe? Or
yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this, but I would love to ask you a question first.
Please.
So how was it for you?
The experience of being classified, it's very strange because people look at me and they, especially I live in Sweden, in Stockholm, and they look at me and a lot of people assume that I'm Swedish. And I used to look at that as a compliment, like, oh, I fit in, you know? But then it's like, no, I'm from Latin America. And there's all these things out there. People are just, you know, attributing something about me without really getting to know me. You know, it's a very light way of saying, oh, I'm being judged by, the color of my skin. But I really was relieved when I've heard some of the participants say that to thank you for doing that. And I really understood that there was a purpose there that I'm not aware to understand. And that kind of confirmed what my intuition was telling me, which is there is a higher purpose for this. And people need to be in a place where they're not automatically judged by the color of their skin. Yeah, that's my reflection on it. Yeah,
it's great. It's great to hear your experience. Mm. So in the book, just to go back to the book for a second, I use this metaphor of concentric circles to talk about this phrase or idea that's used often of margin and center. So we talk about marginalized communities, at least here in the North America, we speak of it that way. But I think it's something that people from other countries can understand, especially countries that have, you know, immigrants and a more multicultural dynamic. And so the idea is that there's a center and that the people on the margins are somehow excluded from the center. And it's often used with this assumption that everybody wants to be in the center, right? It's like there is even a book in, I think, the 80s feminist text, From Margin to Center, you know, that we kind of want to leave the margins. And I kind of argue against that a little bit. Of course, it's a metaphor. It's a simplistic metaphor. The world does not meet concentric circles. But, you know, just for the sake of this exploration, to say the margins actually afford people a more holistic view. And so we often think that, you know, people at the center, let's say wealthy, white, cisgendered men who have a lot of power, you know, if we think of that as the center, that's where the resources are, that's where the access is, you know, it's basically about stuff.
Yeah.
But actually in the center, if everyone's looking in, you don't have a lot of perspective. Like you don't have a lot of understanding of the rest of the world. And the farther out on the margins you are, the more you see. So there can be this sort of reverse understanding of reality that somehow the center gives you objectivity, it gives you access, it gives you understanding, you know, that's where all the knowledge is contained, with this misunderstanding that actually when you're on the margins and you participate in the center, so people who come from the margins but, you know, have jobs in the city or have to interact with those in the center, you're constantly moving in and out. And so you have this capacity to speak many different quote unquote languages. And often we call that code switching. It's the ability to like move in and out of various circles and have some level of adeptness to manage. So often the people from the centers do not move to the margins. So they're not having the same conversations. They're not having the same awareness. A lot of times there's a lot of fatigue amongst people of color. In this case, to talk about race, sometimes when I do workshops, I separate people by gender identity or by sexuality. There are different things that can keep us from understanding the experiences of other people. But the problem with the center is that there can be ignorance and there can be arrogance because there's this perception that there's understanding, but there's a lack of experience of the margins. So having what I call affinity groups, you know, these opportunities to be in particular groups to talk about different things. So we split into groups to talk about ancestry. We split into groups to talk about a relationship with the elements. These are things, not as a whole necessarily, you know, not to, this is a very binary system to say white and POC. And part of the work of talking about ancestry is to break that down. I spoke with the workshop coordinator after that workshop, and she was telling me that in the white groups, there was a really kind of stunted conversation around ancestry because people, a lot of white folks don't explore that. It's probably different in Europe than in the States where people have immigrated and really had to lose their connection to their ancestral origins in order to gain into the whiteness club. But it's a really different conversation for Black folks and immigrants and other people of color who were in those affinity groups than it is for white folks who are touching into something that maybe they haven't explored, don't really understand. I can guarantee you that a lot of those people of color have probably had that conversation. They've probably taken workshops before on identity and race and ancestry. They might have majored in it in college or at least done all the seminars. You know, and so there's just a different level of understanding. And what can happen in that dynamic sometimes when you're in mixed groups talking about this is that there's this kind of voyeuristic tendency of white folks to like want to hear people of color talk about this, and also kind of a parasitic kind of tendency where they're asking people of color to educate them because there is such a difference in a level of understanding of these issues. And that same dynamic could happen around gender. Guarantee you, a lot of women took women's studies courses and have read women authors more or have paid attention to feminist issues more, men maybe not as much. These are generalizations again. It's not that all men or all white people, same things around sexuality. You know, you can have queer folks who have a really deep understanding of the nuances of queer culture and understanding of the languages around, you know, transgender issues. I've really been educating myself. I talk about this a little bit in the book about fatness and the whole history of the anti-fatness as ideology in our culture, and try to educate myself by paying attention to other people. So this is what it means to kind of move to the margins. So rather than waiting for the margins to come to the center, wherever we are centered, to start to move to learn about other cultures, other communities. I'm trying to educate myself right now on disability justice, and it's blowing my mind the things I never thought about in terms of ability and disability and access and resources and what that means. So that's why I create affinity groups in my workshops.
There's one word that you mentioned, you probably didn't even notice it so much, but the word fatigue. And that really struck a chord with me because especially to keep the metaphor of the moving towards the center, that the people doing the moving are the people in the external. And that is tiring. And to go back to the book again, one of the things you talk about is I'm going to have to edit this for a second because the word is semantic vigilance. So when we're able to code switch, and you talk about two different types of code switching. One is fluency, which happens almost effortless, which I have with my sister, for example. We speak in Spanish and English depending on the topic. And when I'm in France, I can speak French without a problem. Same in Italy. I've been very fortunate. I speak multiple languages. So I've always done it from a place of belonging, and it was easy and effortless. But then there was another aspect, which is something that I've been doing most of my life, which is the semantic vigilance, which is...
Semiotic, yeah.
Semantic, yeah, sorry. Semiotic vigilance, thank you. And like I'm making a link between that part of your book and what you've done in your workshop. Could you explain a little bit more about that if you want?
Yeah, so you know, you explained it really well, this idea that there is code switching. People who move through many different cultures or literal languages will often shift, and it can be effortless. But when we feel like we don't belong, it's not actually code switching we're doing, because code switching, I'm really describing something that doesn't have anxiety attached to it. It's just shifting languages, or you know, metaphorical languages depending on the situation. But semiotic vigilance is this kind of fear and guardedness, you know, trepidation or feeling of protection that arises when we have to shift locations. And so to go back to this example of affinity groups, I've experienced this, and I know other people of color have really appreciated, as you mentioned, it was all people of color who commented and thanked me for creating affinity groups, that you can be in situations where you're feeling guarded because there have been so many times when someone has made unaware racist comment or tried to extract from you in the form of asking for more information or challenging what you have to say, and not even realizing that the challenge is laced with a lot of ignorance or misunderstanding. And so this vigilance starts to protect oneself. And, you know, it can be really tiny. I was texting with my brother yesterday, and I was telling him, you know, how my mom, and I mentioned this in the book, really never bought into the colorism that's a big part of Ethiopian culture. So my mom is very, very light-skinned, and I'm dark, the darkest person in my family. And she was basically the only person in my family who didn't comment on my darkness as a negative thing. You know, I was told to get out of the sun and, you know, you're dark enough, and, you know, everyone else. And my brother reminded me, and I totally forgot this, he used to all the time when I was little tell me I was adopted, because how else, you know, I was so dark, and I used to cry, and, you know, and so there's this vigilance about how we look or how we are. And I luckily didn't have that vigilance around my skin color because my mom was so aware of that. You know, she kind of protected against that. But I know plenty of people of color who were really traumatized by this feeling like that they were too dark. And so that the way kind of whiteness and white supremacy seeps into so many cultures, and this is global. As I mentioned, the book Skin Whitening Cream is like an almost billion-dollar industry.
Yeah.
And Asia is actually the biggest market. So this vigilance of how we show up, whether it's the color of our skin or the shade of our skin or our accent, or if we have the right clothes, like everything that makes meaning, that's what semiotics is about, and communicate something about us to the world, we start monitoring and having this vigilance about.
Yeah, my sister, I called my sister the other day and she was telling me about her issues, which are, I'm not going to get into it because she's probably going to listen to this. but she mentioned her insecurities. And then I mentioned mine, that I've always been trying to fit in. I've realized that I put a lot, almost obsessive attention to fitting in, because I've always felt like I didn't fit in. And she was in shock by, I was like, oh, really? You were always so confident and you always seemed like you had it good together. And it just goes to show that how natural it was for me. And but then how hard time we have reading people's anxieties and what story they're telling themselves inside. Mm-hmm. And I think we could all benefit from communicating more clearly and being able to be vulnerable or express our issues that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so, I really identify with that. So many people from my childhood, adolescence especially, characterized me as, super confident, as like an alpha female. And I was like, what are you talking about? You insane? Like, I was a teeming mess of anxiety and fear inside. And so that vigilance can create like that almost like sentinel, kind of a soldier quality, where we're just have this shell of protection. So there isn't that openness and vulnerability that shows what's really going on inside, because a vigilance, you have to be aware and protected. And so that protection can sometimes look like arrogance or confidence, but it's actually masking something that is really defended. It's a really defended heart.
Yeah, it's amazing that you say masking, because like we build a persona, and the word persona comes from the word mask in Greek, which is, it's so spot on. It's very common here in Sweden to have a lot of female-only networking groups, or okay, in Stockholm, and maybe not that I'm aware of, people of color networking groups. Do you think those are helpful, and why, if not?
I've never been to Sweden, so I can't comment too much on Sweden. And, I would say that it's different, of course, because it's a different culture than here. And there are a lot of similarities of experience of being part of a dominant culture, so whether that dominant culture is mixed cultural white or a more kind of uniform cultural white, there is the feeling of separation and marginalization that can happen when a culture is predominantly giving messages to people about what's normal and what's expected. I have cousins who live in Sweden, actually the kids of those cousins born and raised in Sweden. And I've heard them talk some about their experience as Black Swedes. And there is a lot of ignorance and misunderstanding and feelings of separation and not belonging that happen there too. Even if there's not the same issues of maybe economic inequality as grand, gaps, or maybe not the same issues of historical patterns of violence or enslavement, if you're talking about the Americas.
Yeah.
So there's room for understanding there of experience and a sharing of experience that requires that safe space of affinity groups. And, you know, actually, I would take that back. I don't even want to say safe space, because it's not about safety. It's really about efficiency. Like if a group of, for example, Black Swedes kind of have to spend the entire time educating people about their experience and, you know, their perspectives and their understanding, if they're spending that energy in kind of catching up white Swedes to their experience, they actually don't get into the heart of their experience and untangling and healing whatever it is they've been through. At the same time, you know, there has to be a real work on white Swedes' part to really know the true history of things and to know, you know, sometimes Scandinavians can kind of exempt themselves from the taint of colonialism, but all of Europe benefited from colonialism. And colonialism wasn't, you know, just some like expedition to go get tea and spices from other places. Like it was a brutal, brutal project that was really founded in the most ultimate sense of separation from other beings, because we're not even seeing people as not separate, but not seeing other people as human. And constructing, and Northern Europeans were very much involved in the scientific construction of eugenicism and, yeah, and race as a theory. So really,
even with their own people, yeah,
even with their own people, exactly.
Yeah. And the people in Lapland in the north, one of the people that scientists, and I'm using air quotes here, used all these measurements like skull measurements and height and tone of skin to separate the people from Northern Scandinavia. And those measurements or those techniques were actually adopted by the Nazi scientists who came up with this theory of the Aryan.
And sometimes there can be then an intellectual understanding of that, but to actually start to understand how that has impacted you personally through the generations, like what attitudes, what behaviors, what unconscious, and meditation and Buddhist practice in particular is so much about making the unconscious conscious, what kind of unconscious patterning you have. And that cannot be done at the expense of what people of color need to heal and explore. So there's different work that needs to be done. So a networking group is a place to actually explore, I imagine, you know, what would serve you and what's holding you back in your potential of really recognizing your gifts and being the best that you could be professionally and socially and experientially as a person. And those are going to be different things for different people. So that's why women network together, because there are certain aspects of living in a patriarchy that has inhibited them, and that needs to be explored. And that includes the shadow sides of what happens amongst women and the way women treat each other and the ways we have to, you know, really undo those patternings of competition that have been created in women, or ways that we appease the dominant culture in order to get ahead. And so, yeah, it's I think it's such a, instead of seeing it as a problem or something that is unfortunate that we have to be in affinity groups, we could really see it as an opportunity and as a power to actually all of us to get free from these patterns and from this conditioning.
Yeah, I really love what you said about the aspect of efficiency, which is, you know, me being an immigrant, it's something that I maybe dabbled a little bit into it. The question of, you know, where are you from? Or you don't speak Swedish, or where are you from? And then I get to the point that I just don't even want to go into those conversations, because I have repeated myself so many times that, and also my story is quite complicated. So if I tell people, if I'm speaking English, I just tell them I'm Canadian, just because that's the quickest thing. Like, can we just move on? But then I feel like I'm lying to them, because then I used to tell them, oh, I'm Argentinian. And then I'll go into this whole like 5-minute speech. And they're like, I was just making chit-chat. So it's, the question of efficiency, it's a really good way of putting into it. And the other thing that you mentioned on, and it's something that I reflected upon, what some of the work that you've done over the years is that you mentioned, is you talk about belonging, that it's possible across affinity groups. And I think you hinted in your book that your vision of belonging is one that bypasses all these kind of affinity groups, and it's possible to belong anywhere and with everybody, regardless of their background or their race. And can you talk a little bit more how you envision that, and what does that world look like? Because you also reminded me that if we want to create a better future, we have to first imagine it.
Mm.
And I thought that was so powerful. So can you talk a little bit about how you envision the world? And
you know, it's such a deep question, and yeah. It's very powerful. And it's hard for me to answer because I don't think that I can imagine the details of the world so much, because, you know, of course, I hope that everyone has access to what they need to stay healthy and well and housed and fed and warm, or that we're using the least amount of resources to take care of as many people as possible, that there is more equality of access and of resources between people and between countries. And so all of the kind of the material realities would have to change radically in order for us to come to some sense of belonging that really honors everyone's right to health and happiness and beauty and education and freedom and all of these things. But I could say more clearly, I think, you know, how I would want to feel. And so coming back to this work starts from the inside, that, you know, I still have spaces where I feel like I don't belong. And there are still times when I show up and I can see, because of who's there, or, you know, in, even on Zoom, you know, that I have doubts about myself. You know, it's not like we never evaluate. I teach, and then, you know, I consider what I could have said differently or done differently. But sometimes, you know, I do something, and a podcast or a teaching, and then for days, I kind of doubt myself and say, oh, why didn't they say this? I'm done. It's not coming from kind of...
You too do that.
Kind of,
yeah, of course. I'm the same, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that to me points to some remnants of that semiotic vigilance that really is in some battle with myself and in battle with the world, and having some kind of internalization of these systems of domination, separation. And so what I would hope is that we're all healing that, you know, and actually meeting each other with that freshness that our practice really encourages, to moment to moment, to really see the truth of another person's beauty and perfection. So even if I encounter a homeless person, which happens all the time in New York, that it's not coming from a place of pitying or compassion that's rooted in kind of thinking that their life should be different than it is. It is what it is. And actually, can I meet them in their humanity in this moment exactly as they are, and really see them clearly as someone that still has dignity and still has their full humanity intact, and their circumstances don't diminish that. You know, that takes a real sense of belonging to the other person, not seeing that person as separate from myself. And from there, maybe I want to help them, or, you know, give them money, or, but it's not coming from a place of greater than, less than, or equal to.
You touched on another topic that I'm going to explore in future podcasts, which is the importance of being seen and belonging. And I forgot which country it's from, but there's a word called Sawibana, which is hello in
South Africa.
South Africa.
I think it's Xhosa, I think.
It literally means that I see you, and it's how they greet and they say hello, which I think it's fundamental to belonging. And here I notice it because people don't look at each other passing on the street. It's very Scandinavian. I had a friend of mine that went back to Canada, and she's been living here for several years. And so I'm like, oh, you just went back to Canada. How was it? How was it? And, you know, I thought she would say, oh, it was great seeing the parents or eating the same junk food that I had as a kid. But no, she said, well, you know, when I go back to Canada, I feel like I exist again. And I'm like, what? It's like, yeah, you know, people see you and people talk to you. You're standing in a checkout line and somebody sparks up a conversation. That never happens here in Scandinavia. Everybody is in their own shell, and with smartphones even more so. You could literally just go through the day without having eye contact with anybody else. And
to me, that's part of that conversation we were having before of kind of margin and center. So in the center, you lose that, right? So you gain access to these resources or power or, you know, the lie of objectivity, but you're actually disconnected from your humanity because it's isolated in the center.
Oh my God, yeah. I don't know why I didn't notice that. Thank you. That's why you are who you are. You're so insightful. And we barely scratch the surface of the amount of knowledge and wisdom that there's compacted in your book. And I think you, by far, when I started off this journey of my podcast, one of the first things I did, add research and I stumbled on your book thanks to... out of all places, out of Amazon. And I clicked on the sample, which is the, you know, your voice comes on the audiobook. And I hear your first chapter. I literally felt goosebumps because I heard somebody talk about belonging in the way that I was feeling it. And I read a whole bunch of books on belonging, but none of them came close to what you have done with your book. So I just wanted to say thank you so much for the way you have influenced my thinking around belonging. And both your wisdom and many of the lessons that we talked about today and that are going to be present in your book are going to be reoccurring through future episodes. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your book. But before we end this conversation, how can people that want to know more about you besides getting your book, which of course I'm going to have links on where you get your book, where can they connect with you? Where can they know more about you, about the work you're doing?
Well, first of all, thank you for your kind words. Really, Matteo, I'm really honored. And it's the best thing for someone who writes a book, I imagine, to hear that it's impacted folks and they connect with it. So I really appreciate that. And then you can find me on my website, sabaneselassie.com. And I do most of my social media stuff on Instagram and try and post regularly there, both what's going on, but also thoughts and things that are maybe not in my newsletter. And so I kind of keep those two things separate. You know, my newsletter, I talk about more in-depth issues. You can sign up on my website and on Instagram, kind of just what's going on with me day to day. So use both of those spaces to explore.
Yeah. And I encourage everybody to connect with you. And you are a beacon of light when it comes to understanding who we are and belonging. Thank you so much for being here today. For me, it's a dream come true. And then I thought, well, it came true. Maybe I should dream bigger. But I really
definitely dream bigger.
But really, it is when I found your book, I'm like, oh, maybe, you know, I could get her on the podcast. And I'm like, no, she's too important. I'm just so humbled and thank you.
Thank you, Matteo.
So there we have it. Together with part one, this wraps up my conversation with Sabine Selassie. Usually at this time, I tend to share with you my takeaways, but as you can see, there are just so many for me to choose from. I guess it's because I'm such a fanboy of Sabine and her book and all the work that she does. And so it's really easy for me to say I loved every single second of this interview. And what were some of the key takeaways for you? Please let me know by commenting on LinkedIn or sending me an email to createbelonging@gmail.com. I will be more than happy to reply and to connect with you. And if you wanted somebody else's takeaways, I invite you to listen to episode 6 and maybe 7 of the Create Belonging podcast, where I interview Christine Grimsdotter and we kick off the conversation talking about Sabine's book and how it has resonated with her values and her quest to help others live in authenticity. So please go back and listen to that episode. And I'm sure that now that you've listened to this two-part conversation, you will better understand Christine's take on the book. And if you haven't picked up the book by now, please go ahead. And if you don't want to get the physical book, try to find the audiobook. As I said, it's narrated by Sabine herself, and you could just plow through it or savor it on your walks. And this is a book that I have on my phone, and every so often I do revisit it. And if you made it this far, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Thank you for those that comment, like, and send me your positive vibes and support. It really means a lot. And if you thought this episode was insightful or you learned something, please share it with your network. It's these word of mouth references that really help grow our community. And I think we could all benefit from bringing the conversation of belonging to the forefront. So that's it. I hope you really enjoyed the show. And before I let you go, I want to remind you to go create belonging for yourself and for others. Bye.